So now, Ernie Bono, a member of Our Lady Star of the Sea Parish, is going to come out, and good friend of Coach Tom Coughlin, who will be assisting us with our final speaker today. On January 9th, 2017, Tom Coughlin was named Executive Vice President of Football Operations for the Jaguars. Coughlin ranks as the 12th winningest coach in NFL history, a veteran of 29 years in the NFL and 21 as a head coach. During his career, he's won 182 NFL games, including two Super Bowls, and his 12 wins in the playoffs ranks 7th in NFL history. Coughlin-led teams have captured 5 divisional titles and 9 playoff berths. Coughlin served as inaugural head coach for the Jaguars, as I know you all remember well, for 9 wonderful seasons from 1994 to 2002. During that time, he accumulated a 68-60 regular season record and 4 playoff appearances, including leading the Jaguars to 2 AFC championship games. Coughlin led the Giants to 2 Super Bowl victories against the New England Patriots in Super Bowl 42 and Super Bowl 46. And we know there's another one headed our way now, right? Becoming the 13th coach in NFL history to claim multiple Super Bowl titles. He's also one of 19 head coaches with a perfect record in Super Bowl games. Under Coughlin's leadership, the Jacksonville Jaguars quickly became the league's most successful expansion team, becoming the first club to qualify for playoff appearances in 4 of its first 5 seasons. In 1996, the Jaguars qualified for the playoffs and advanced to the AFC Championship game in just their 2nd season, as Coughlin was named NFL Coach of the Year by United Press International. The team won its first division title in 1998. The following season, Coughlin led the Jaguars to an NFL best record of 14-2 and again advanced to the conference title game. Coach Coughlin began his coaching career as a graduate assistant at Syracuse, where he was a 3-year letterman from 1965 through 67. He also served as the school's quarterbacks coach from 1974 through 76 and offensive coordinator from 1977 to 1980. From 1988 to 1990, Coughlin was the Giants wide receivers coach under Bill Parcells and was on the staff when the team won its 2nd Super Bowl. He held the same position with the Green Bay Packers in 1986 and 87 and the Philadelphia Eagles in 85 and 86. Prior to being the head coach of the Jacksonville Jaguars, Coughlin spent 3 seasons as head coach at Boston College. And of course, as we all well know, I'm sure, Coach Coughlin, wonderful steward of Jacksonville and local nonprofits and initiatives right here in our beautiful city. Mr. Coughlin was born on August 31st, 1946 in Waterloo, New York. He's the oldest of 7 children. Coughlin and his wife, Judy, have 2 daughters and 11 grandchildren. Please, folks, help me in welcoming back to Jacksonville, Coach Tom Coughlin.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for inviting Ernie and I to the Jesus Pep Rally. We're glad to be here. It's good to see all the faces, and I know you've had a long day, but we're going to inject a little energy into this room as we get started here. My buddy Ernie will take it from here.
Good afternoon, everyone. You got to help me out here a little bit. Good afternoon, everyone. That's better. I need some motivation today. At any rate, the way this is going to work is pretty simple. I'm going to ask Coach some questions, probably some of the questions that some of you would like to ask him, but I have the privilege of doing that. You know, I think if you think about this session, you need to be thinking about divine providence, God's loving care for us as we go through these questions, because there's a lot of symbolism here, but there's a lot of reality in this. Sometimes in life, you don't get exactly what you want. You ever feel that way? And sometimes in life, life brings you difficulties. And how you cope with those difficulties is very important. Coach Coughlin is an example of that. And I'd like to start off with a question. Quite frankly, Coach, you and I have something very much in common in that when we were young, we both were educated by the Sisters of St. Joseph. And I know how they affected my life. Could you tell us how they affected your life?
I can tell you how they affected my life. We stood at attention. We marched in the room. The Sisters of St. Joseph, for me, were the beginning. My dad went to St. Mary's Parochial Grammar School. We all were going to go to St. Mary's Parochial Grammar School. There was no discussion. And the thing that always impressed me, even as a youngster, was the devotion of the nuns to us, the students. They gave literally their lives for their students. And in my day, we had two classes in one room. You'd have the first grade on one side, the second grade on another. You'd be so forth right on through the eighth grade. And what the sisters taught us was discipline, respect. Certainly, the respect part of it went a long way, because this could be attributed to religion, ethics, morality. However you wanted to spell it out, the nuns were there for that purpose. But the thing that always, that I'll never forget, I'll always remember, is my sixth grade teacher was Sister Rosales. Now, Sister Rosales was faster, jumped higher, punched harder, and was a better athlete than any of us ever thought of being, and she was in her habit. So it was amazing to watch her operate. But along with that came the idea that at a parochial grammar school, you became an altar boy. And as you became an altar boy, you also understood responsibility and accountability, because the way that we were taught, first of all, with Father McCall at 7 o'clock Mass, was you were just on the altar and he was directing traffic. But you'd soon have the 6 o'clock Mass on Sunday morning. And I, as Ernie did as a youngster, I became the master of ceremonies at midnight Mass on Christmas, the vigil Mass at Easter, which was a big responsibility, the altar full of priests. A friend of mine from high school, from parochial school, and I was the master, he was the second master. But a big, big part of the establishment of who you are as an individual, who I was, what I learned as a youngster, not only at home with mom and dad, as was stated, I was the oldest of seven, but the way in which the school and the parents worked together to raise the child. In other words, the nun would tell you what to do. And I can remember one time, snowing like crazy, central New York, and I'm at the door. We're going to get out early, and we up the street, some of my friends were riding the bumper, the back bumper of cars as they tried to go up the street. And the nun said to me, "Now, don't you do that. I said, "Don't worry, sister, I'm not going to do that." Right over there, I'm riding up the street on the back of the car. She makes one phone call home, and I walk in the door, and there's no defense. You have nothing to say. You are absolutely wrong, and you are not, there's none of this enabling. There's none of this putting their arm around you, but you poor kid, the nun is it. No, that's not the way it worked in my house. My father and mother would meet you at the door, and that was it. You were in big trouble, and it was all because if you happened to cross the nun, the phone call came.
Your experience was very similar to mine. The difference was I was kicked out of fifth grade glee club by Sister Mary Felix. But at any rate, Coach, wherever I go, people ask me, how did you and Coach Coffin get to be friends? And it's been so long ago, I don't even remember.
Well, this is interesting, because when I was hired here as the head coach of the Jacksonville Jaguars to get the franchise started in 94, I was one of seven employees, and we actually worked in a trailer. That's all there was. The stadium was knocked down. There was one stanchion, mud up to your ankles when you went to work, you know, the whole deal. So I had a couple of days into the job, I noticed the messages were from Ernie Bono. Who the heck is Ernie Bono? And I kept asking the gal out front, who's Ernie Bono? Anybody know Ernie Bono? So finally, Ernie called. I took the phone call. He came down to visit me. And the way this all started was Ernie's high school football coach was a guy by the name of Pat Martin. And Pat Martin had called Ernie and said, look, because I was with the Philadelphia Eagles for a couple of years. Pat was always in Philly. He was a high school coach in Philly. Then he worked as a scout in Canadian football. But Pat had called Ernie and said, you know, Coughlin's a pretty good guy. Why don't you get to know him and help him? Don't talk about football. Don't ask him any football questions. Just ask him or talk to him about schools and where he should live and so on and so forth. Make him familiar with the community. So Ernie came down. We talked. He invited me to dinner. My family wasn't with me. I was there by myself. So I drove out one night to Marsh Landing to have dinner with Ernie and Rita and their beautiful family. And once I got there and I sat down at the table, and it was Ernie Jr., it was Chris, and it was Dana. Dana the younger, she was probably in the sixth grade at that time. But I quickly learned that the Bono dining room table, everything was okay. Any subject you wanted to discuss could be discussed at the table. There was no reservations. It was an educational experience for me to be with the Bonos at dinner. But I had learned a little bit about this because my best friend in high school was an Italian kid, and every time I would go to his house, I would have to sit down and have dinner. So that's the way we got started, and a friendship that's lasted an awful lot of years, quite frankly, and simply because, in my opinion, one of the finest human beings on the face of the earth is Ernie Bono.
And that goes double for me in regard to you. And we've had many discussions about spirituality and God, and I'd like you to share with everyone, how do you feel God works in our lives? How did God work in your life?
God worked in my life, has worked in my life in many, many ways. You call it divine providence. You call it, I call it the miracles that have happened to me along the way, and there have been many, probably more than I could possibly mention. But to give you a great example of how God has worked in my life, I'll move quickly, but when I finished parochial grammar school, I went to high school in my town of Waterloo, New York. And I played football, basketball, and baseball. Our teams had great success. We won a lot of championships. And at that time, I became aware of major college football. And I remember the Ben Schwartzwalder show. Ben Schwartzwalder was the head coach at Syracuse University. It started with Jim Brown in 1959. They were the national champions. I only wanted to go to one school. So I went to Syracuse, had a great experience at Syracuse, loved playing at Syracuse. I went to school with Larry Zonka, Floyd Little. Those guys were in my backfield. When I graduated from Syracuse, I became a football coach. I was a GA there. Then I went to a small Division III school, and then back to Syracuse as an assistant football coach. So in my young career, born in Waterloo, New York, in the Finger Lakes region, with Rochester 50 miles one way, Syracuse 45 miles the other way, I had never been any further than 50 miles on either side of Syracuse. I coached at Syracuse University from 1974 through the 1980 season. And at that time, we were an okay football team. We would win 6 games one year, 5 the next, 7 the next, so on and so forth. Never to the point where we could be, you know, a great football team. And Syracuse was going through some things at that time, too, about supporting their Division I football program. Budgets were small, et cetera, et cetera. After the 1980 season, Frank Maloney, who was the head coach at Syracuse, resigned. And all of a sudden, we were out. Now, this is my alma mater. I mean, a school that the only school I ever wanted to attend. The experience as a player was a tremendous experience. Played in a lot of bowl games, played with some, you know, with a lot of great football players. The experience as a coach, not as good. Although we coached a lot of great players. Art Monk, Joe Morris, Bill Hurley, Jim Collins. These are guys that we, you know, went on to play professional football that we had the opportunity to coach. But now I'm out. I don't have a job. I've got 2 kids. My wife is pregnant. You know, it's one of those deals where what's coming next? And I began to entertain thoughts of doing something other than coaching. But in the meantime, along came an opportunity to either go to Canada to work with Frank Cush in the Canadian Football League, or I had an opportunity to interview with Jack Bicknell, who was the new head coach at Boston College. Well, I decided to go to Boston College. At first, I really didn't want to go because I had played against Boston College my entire college career, and, you know, one of those rivalry things, and I wasn't real crazy about going to BC. But I did agree to go to Boston College to be what ended up being the offensive coach there. And the good Lord gave us this opportunity. But along the way, the first year, the seventh quarterback on our football team at Boston College was a young man by the name of Doug Flutie. I coached Doug Flutie for the first 3 years of his career, obviously a Heisman Trophy winner, a great football player. We had a lot of very good football players, but the opportunity to go to a Jesuit school, Boston College, to feel as comfortable as I possibly could in that environment and be able to coach somebody like Doug Flutie and win a lot of football games, certainly this was the good Lord's way of saying, well, I didn't know what he had planned. I had no idea. I had to trust and have faith in his and him leading me in the right direction. But to go there and to be able to be with some wonderful people, the president at that time was a gentleman by the name of Father Donald Monin. Father Monin just passed away at the age of 93. But to go to Boston College to coach Doug Flutie, that was a wonderful experience for me.
Well, you know, Boston College, some of the stories that we talk about, really probably the J Fund emanated from Boston College. Tell everybody about Jay McGillis.
Okay. So the next, after I leave Boston College, I went to the Philadelphia Eagles for 2 years. I went to the Green Bay Packers for two, back to the New York Giants for three. The third year that I was with the New York Giants, we won Super Bowl 25. So you talk about a wonderful experience. Super Bowl 25 was a wonderful experience. We had a great football team. We beat a great team, and the Buffalo Bills, who were outstanding. So at that point in time, during that last year, I had the opportunity, it was 1990, to have the Boston College people call me and ask me if I was interested in being the head coach. And at first I said no. We were 10-0. I was not going to be a distraction. I did not want to get involved in that. But eventually they came back, and we had played 13 games. We were a really good football team. I went to Bill Parcells. He didn't think it was going to be a distraction. So I talked to the Boston College people. They offered me the job. I took the job. And after we won the Super Bowl in 1990, I went to Boston College in January of 1991 to become their head football coach. And the idea of taking over a new program, something I've done, something I did when I'm here, but some of that came back to me in terms of how I wanted to treat this group of young men. They had lost for five straight years, so I was going to make it a very difficult experience for them. One of the young men who played for us was a guy by the name of Jay McGillis. Jay was a strong safety. I can still see Jay running around the indoor track on part of our off-season 6 a.m. Workout sessions. Jay was our starting strong safety. We played 10 games that year, came back from a road loss, and the trainers came to me and said, Jay can't play this week. I said, what do you mean he can't play? Well, he's got swollen glands, and he's not feeling well. He has a temperature. It may be mononucleosis. It may be, you know, just swollen glands. We don't know, but he's going to have to go through a series of tests. I said, okay, test him. Let's go. Let's see, you know, we can get him back on the field. Well, it wasn't mononucleosis. It was leukemia. And throughout the course of the next few months, we saw Jay McGillis and his family go through what a family goes through, running to the bedside of the sick child, having to be there for the child who's sick, dropping, not going to work, letting bills mount up, putting themselves in a terrible situation, but they were there to support and to provide a positiveness to the child, thinking everything was going to be okay. So we had this experience. In July of 1992, Jay McGillis passed away. At that time, he weighed 82 pounds. He was a 195-pound strapping kid who was a strong safety. But the devastation of this disease took its toll. One of my linebackers came to me, a guy by the name of Mike Panos, and said, Coach, we've got to do something for the McGillis family. So we said, we talked about this, and we came up with an idea of having, in those days, your football team lifted in the spring. They would bench press, power clean, squat thrust, squat, and we would take this idea and go into the community and get pledges from people who would give us money for the McGillis family based on how well we did with our end of the season max lifts. At the spring game, at halftime of the spring game, we presented the McGillis family with a check for $50,000. And thus the idea began of something that Judy and I knew that when we left Boston College, if we had an opportunity to give back, it would be in the spirit of Jay McGillis, and we would be there for families who have a child who has cancer. And we would be there financially, emotionally, practically. We would be there for the areas in which things fell through the cracks. So when we had that opportunity, then we established the J Fund.
Yeah, that's such an interesting story. And, you know, Coach, we have some Notre Dame fans out there. We have some Boston College fans out there. But we also have some Florida State fans out there. And just to set the stage here, because I consider this, I'm biased, maybe the greatest college football game ever played when Notre Dame was number one and you came in, you weren't even ranked. Florida State didn't have a chance of being number one. And tell them what your team did.
Well, this was the end. This was the 1993 season. So in 92 and 93, we became a much better football team. And in 93, the year before we went to South Bend, Florida State, if you remember, went to South Bend. They were the number one team in the country. They lost to Notre Dame. Notre Dame became the number one team in the country. We came in the next weekend, Boston College, and I have to tell you the story. Notre Dame beat us the year before 54-13 or something like that. And in the course of doing so, they faked a punt in the middle of the third quarter with a lead, with a substantial lead. Well, our memories were pretty good, and the motivation for our players was there. And so we went into South Bend, and no one gave us a chance to win. How could Boston College beat this powerhouse? And they were a powerhouse. There was Lou Holtz was the head coach. They were very well coached. They were a great football team. Well, we beat them and knocked them out of the number one position, and Florida State became the national champion that year. But the way that happened was there was a young man by the name of David Gordon who became our kicker. He was our field goal kicker. We jumped out real early in the game and took a big lead. They roared back. At the end of the game, we marched it down the field, and with just a few seconds left in the game, David Gordon would go on the field to make or to attempt a field goal that would defeat this outstanding Notre Dame football team. Well, David goes out. David Gordon was a guy who shoveled snow in the wintertime to make a spot to put his tee so he could kick. So he was a hard-working kid. And I remember saying to David, David, go kick the ball. Just hit it squarely. Everything else will take care of itself. David Gordon goes in, the snap, the hold, the ball is kicked. In the beginning, the kick's outside the uprights. But he hits a screwball that comes right back into the uprights. And the kick is made, and we beat Notre Dame 41-39. Now, what's important to realize how the good Lord works, the spot to which the ball was placed for this field goal was the 31-yard line. Jay McGillis's number was 31. It was a 41-yard field goal that defeated this outstanding Notre Dame team, and Florida State became the national champion.
Coach, I knew they'd like that story. Coach, let's go back to the J Fund. We've been at this, I think, 22 years together, maybe close to 23. Why don't you tell the folks a couple stories that we've experienced in the J Fund that somewhat give us a sense of resolve and a sense of enthusiasm and a sense that we know we're doing the right thing and that God has blessed us so tremendously.
Well, first of all, we come to Jacksonville to be the head coach of the Jacksonville Jaguars. And in 94, we put a team together. 95, we play. 96, we play. In 96, at the conclusion of the season, we have our first ever Tom Coughlin J Fund Foundation experience. And we have, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. I was basically the person who had found the foundation. I asked Ernie to join me. Fran Foley was in our pro football organization as a scout. I asked Fran when I brought him here from Boston College, I said, Fran, you're going to help me, and we're going to develop the J Fund Foundation. So it was Ernie, Fran, and I. Our first event was a golf tournament. We were in the land of golf. We didn't know how we were going to raise money, but we started our first ever golf tournament. This will be our 22nd this year, by the way. But we started our first ever golf tournament, and that year we raised $36,000, and we thought we were doing really well. In the meantime, in all these years, we have helped over 4,000 families. Over $7.5 million has been donated to families who have a child with cancer. And some of the experiences, thank you. But for some, and it's not this crowd, for some who would question the presence of God, question the presence of Jesus Christ, this is an amazing story because of the families that we've had the privilege of working with. One I'll mention that Ernie and I were both involved in was a young gal by the name of Lila, who was 3 years old. She had leukemia, and we and her family needed the help of the J Fund. So we were helping the Birchnell family, and Lila had leukemia. Well, after a very difficult battle, Lila could not be treated anymore. Ernie and I went to the house one Saturday morning. Actually, I had practice early Saturday morning, and between then and reporting to the hotel that night for our meetings prior to the next day's game, Ernie and I went to the house. And we went in the house, and we'll never forget this. The grandfather and grandmother were there. Lila's baby sister, Kate, was crawling around on the floor. Ryan Birchnell was trying to be the most courageous of fathers. Mom held Lila in her arms, trying to make her comfortable here, and it was the last few hours of her life. And I will never forget this. And I looked at Ernie with amazement. Lila, at 3 years old, looked in her mother's eyes and she said, and I quote, she said, "Mom, I'll be okay. I'll be okay." How does a three-year-old who is just starting out in life, who's about to lose her life, how does a three-year-old know to comfort her mother at the time of Lila's imminent death? It's the Holy Spirit. There's no other explanation. There's no other explanation. And there's lots of stories like that. This past Christmas, I went to visit a young boy in Hackensack Hospital in New York. His name was Joey. One day he's out in the yard playing football. The next day, he's in the hospital with leukemia. He's scared to death. 7-year-old boy. He can't get away from his mother. When we stopped at his room to visit the child and bring a Christmas present, they did not want to see anybody. Mom came outside of the room. She let it be known to one of the social workers who was with us that Joey's mom wanted us to come into the room. So my wife Judy and I went into the room where Joey was all curled up in the fetal position, scared to death, crying like a baby. And his mom told him that I was there and that Joey had played Pop Warner football. And to move Joey in the right direction, we began talking about football and how I felt, and I told Joey this, the safety position is a position in which you can't find players anymore. Because of the way the college game has gone, the normal safeties that we would see size-wise are now playing linebacker. And I told Joey, we need players at the safety position, and we need you to get better in order for you to get back on the field and someday be a college football player and eventually a professional football player. About 2 months later, when the family was in grave doubt as to whether Joey was going to be in remission or whether he was going to have to go back and go through severe treatments again just to save his life, I got a call from Lynn Chwosky, who works for the J Fund in New York. She asked me if I would call and talk to Joey again. I called. Joey didn't want to talk. Then Joey got on the phone. And Joey spoke, and I spoke to Joey again about, Joey, you got to get better. You can't stop fighting. You got to fight this disease. You'll lick it. You'll be able to play in the side yard and play again at some point, and you'll become a pro football player. Joey tells his mother The next day, Mom, I got to get better. I have to go to Jacksonville and play for the Jaguars for Coach Coughlin. And Joey found out that afternoon that he was in remission. But these stories, these kind of stories are now we lose children too. And that is an extremely difficult thing. Ernie and I went to see a young African-American teenager, and his grandmother was in the room with him. And we went in, and he was obviously very close to death, but he was, his body had lotion everywhere, so his body wouldn't crack. He was so dry and so on and so forth. And as we looked at this young man, it was just an incredible feeling, the courage demonstrated by his grandmother, knowing full well that in a matter of hours, he was going to pass away. But these are the kinds of experiences that we have with children and their families that we help through the J Fund. And there's many, many more stories about, I mean, we have, our golf tournament is preceded by a dinner on Sunday night. Last year, two kids that we helped were there, two beautiful girls who are graduating from college, starting careers, who have defeated cancer and have gone on with the help of the J Fund and helping their families to create opportunities for themselves going forward in life. So those are the stories that we like to tell. And the greatest compliment I've ever received is a father told me that, you know, our daughter has cancer. We applied for every known source of help. No one responded. The J Fund was notified. Next day, the check was there to help us. Those are the stories.
You know, Coach, these stories are, you know, continue to just give me great resolve. And then I think about you, future Hall of Famer, two-time Super Bowl winner. But the fact that the work that you've done for the J Fund allowed me to be privileged to help you, that is going to be your greatest legacy when it's all said and done. Coach, tell us a little bit, as the time is winding down, the first time you came to Jacksonville. Tell us that story. That's an interesting story, I think.
That's a great story. So I'm at Boston College. I'm the head coach at Boston College. We had just won a bowl game against the University of Virginia. Remember the CarQuest Bowl? Matter of fact, the score of the CarQuest Bowl, 31 to 13 was the score of the CarQuest Bowl. So I'm back in my office, and I'm thinking, you know, I was worried that I was going to have to leave to go to pro football, and a couple things had come and gone. And so I thought, well, we've got another opportunity here. We had a top 25 recruiting class. We had a good football team, et cetera, et cetera. So one day when I came to work in January, my assistant said, one of our players was just here, and he is applying for a job, and he wanted to know if you would give him a recommendation. So I thought that a recommendation was coming that day. So I start to work, and a phone call comes a little bit later in the day, and my assistant says, it's the Jaguars calling. I thought she was talking about a car dealership. And I thought that this player of mine was trying to get a job with a car dealership, and that's why they were calling me. So I pick up the phone, and I'm sitting there, and the guy says, I'm David Selden. I'm the president of the Jacksonville Jaguars. You know, we just became an expansion team in November. Started telling me about it. I really didn't know much about it because that was our season. I was not paying attention to anything else. And he asked me, he said, you know, we're trying to find a head coach. Would you be interested in talking to us about our job? And I said, how many people do you have involved? And he said, 5. And I said, well, I'm not interested then. He said, you're not interested in talking to us about our job if there's 5 people? I said, no, I'm not interested in talking to you about this job if there's 5 people. He said, can I call you again? I said, yeah, you call me all you want, but I'm not interested if there's 5 people. So about 2 weeks later, he calls back and he said, would you be interested in talking to us if there was 2 people? Now that's a little different story. So the rest is history. Wayne Weaver and David Selden come to Providence. I go for the interview. I told my wife when I left, I said, I'm just going to be gone about an hour and there's nothing going to happen. So I go and the interview takes place and pretty much they offer me the job. So I come home and, I have to tell my wife and my teenage son that, who I had told would graduate from high school in Boston, that probably wasn't going to be the case. But anyway, we take the job in Jacksonville. We come to Jacksonville. We spend a couple of years putting this thing together. And all of you remember, and it was just mentioned here, that the first 5 years are the most successful in the history of any expansion team in any sport. We are in the AFC Championship game twice. We take off in our second year, and we go to Denver, and we beat the John Elway Denver Broncos there. We come home here. Our plane flies over the stadium. There's 35,000 of you people in the stadium. Recognizing our team as we get home. And it was just a wonderful experience those 5 years, although we really should have, we were the better team in 99 and should have went to the Super Bowl in 99. But we got beat in the championship game. But 3 years later, I get fired. So here we go again. I'm at Syracuse. That career ends. I don't know where any of this is going to go. I'm not sure. We get fired after the 2002 season. It moves into January of 2003, and I'm trying to figure out what has the good Lord got planned now. We stay in Jacksonville. We continue to live in Jacksonville, even though, I'm no longer the Jaguar coach. But the plan starts to unfold for me. I'm able for the first time. I never would have been able to do this. Our first grandchild is born. And I'm able to go with my wife and be a part of that magnificent experience. My first grandson is born. We're able to be a part of that magnificent experience. And I'm able to experience this all during the winter months, the spring, et cetera, et cetera. A good friend of mine, Will McDonough, who's a classic writer for the Boston Globe, passes away. And I get an opportunity to go to Boston and pay our respects to Will's family. Never would have been able to do that because of football season. He died during the fall. In January of 2004, I get a call from the New York Giants, and I have an opportunity to go to New York and interview for the head coaching position with the New York Giants. I get the New York Giant job. And the rest is history. And I have the good Lord's plan because I have two children who have their families in New Jersey, and I have two children that have their families in Jacksonville. So I have an opportunity, whether I'm in New York, New Jersey, or whether I'm here, to be with my family. And again, the good Lord is working.
So here again, you take disappointment and turn it into success. And you honestly believe that the good Lord is shedding his grace on you like he does all of us. So let's talk about the Super Bowl, that first one. Let's talk about the adversity that you had during that year and how you won the Super Bowl.
Well, I say this to you. The good Lord has a plan. But it's not an easy one. I don't think anybody gets guaranteed any easy road. At least in my experience, it never was that way. So I go to New York. We draft Eli Manning. Eli is a rookie quarterback. I have Kurt Warner, who's a Hall of Fame quarterback. After the seventh game, I insert Eli Manning into the lineup, much to the chagrin of a lot of people. We come back. That's the 2000. And fourth season. We come back in 2005, win 11 games, get in the playoffs. Come back in 2006, win 8 games, get in the playoffs, but we get knocked out of the playoffs in the first round, and the media wants me fired. The media decides that they've had enough of Coughlin. They want to get rid of Coughlin. And the players are grumbling, too, in a lot of different ways. So how are we going to attack this issue? Pat Hanlon, who's the vice president of media operations for the New York Giants, who is a great friend of mine. He came up with a plan. We're going to bring each member of the media in, and there's a lot of media in New York. We're going to bring each one of those people in, and they're going to sit across from you, and you're going to take the gloves off, tell them what you don't like about them, and they're going to tell you what they don't like about you, and you're going to solve some problems that way. To be honest with you, of course, the guys that were calling for my head would come in and say, well, that wasn't me. I wasn't calling for your, I didn't want you fired. So anyway, but we did have a good experience, and I gained from that experience because I learned that I'm a blue-collar guy, and these people are blue-collar people trying to do their job the best they possibly can, and I wasn't helping them to a very good degree to be the best that they could be at their profession. So I changed. I knew I could include them in some of the information that I had about our team. I would never tell them the things that were most secretive and important to me, but they could have more information. So that's the way that began, with more respect for them. With the players, I developed a leadership council. And the leadership council, by doing that, I put players from all the positions on our team in position where they could have responsibility for their team. And I would ask them for their opinion on certain things and give them responsibility. And that seemed to work out very well. So the spring work of 2007 seemed to be going very well. It was very successful. So we start the year off and we go 0-2. We get beat in two straight ball games. And the new defensive coordinator that I hire has given up 80 points in two games. So it's not looking too good. So we go to Washington in the division for our third game, and we meet a young man by the name of Greg Gadsden. Colonel Gadsden has lost both legs in Iraq. He is a classmate of Mike Sullivan, who at that time was my receiver coach, at West Point. So Mike came to me and he said, Coach, could Greg Gadsden come over and say hello to us when we get to Washington on Saturday night? And I said, sure, but tell me more about Greg Gadsden. So I got on the phone with Greg Gadsden, and I found out the kind of individual he is, the values, what he believes in, very similar to what I believe in. Great all-American work ethic, humility, teamwork, those values. And so I asked Greg to speak to our team. And it just so happened the room we had was just a rectangular room, but it had a hallway outside where Greg could come down the hallway in his wheelchair. And then he entered the room from the side. And the players who knew that Greg was going to speak were not aware of the fact that he was a military hero who had been literally dead on the side of the road with no pulse, no blood pressure, was brought back to life, lost both legs. But his attitude and his mindset was exactly the same as he was when he took his division to Iraq. The next day, we're down at halftime. We come back out, we drive the ball down, we score, we take the lead. They come down at the end of the game. They throw a pass down to our 1 yard line with 1 minute to play. We're ahead. They have to have a touchdown. The ball's on the 1 yard line. We have a great goal line stand. We stop them. They throw a play-action pass to stop the clock. They call two runs to the left. We stop them both times. We win the game. That kind of confidence carries us on. We win six in a row. We get to the end of the season, and we have three games left. We have to win one to get in the playoffs. So we promptly lose to the Washington Redskins at home with a backup quarterback. The next morning, all the players think I'm coming in to just rip them a new one, because that, quite frankly, is what they deserve. Sometimes you have to change up. So I walk in the room, I look them in the eye, and I said, gentlemen, we have two games remaining. We go to Buffalo this weekend. I suggest we defeat Buffalo so that we can get in the playoffs, because if we don't, our last game of the year is against the undefeated New England Patriots. So we go to Buffalo, we beat Buffalo. We come back home, and of course, now the media starts on the, you're going to rest your players. Rest your players, because you're in the playoff. New England's in the playoff. I'm not going to rest my players, because history is not going to record that the New York Giant franchise is not going to play their best players and give their best effort to defeat a team that has a chance to go undefeated. So we have a great game against them. They beat us 38-35. We take the lead. We didn't hold the lead at the end of the game, but it was a heck of a football game and it earned their respect, and our players knew they could play against them. I go in the next morning to look at the tape. There's a light on my phone. I play the voicemail message. It's from John Madden. He says, "Tom, I want you to know that what you and your players did yesterday is the greatest thing that happened in the National Football League in the last 10 years. Football is a game of competition. It's being your best. It's playing your best. It's not about resting players. It's about giving your all each time you play. It's about the integrity of the game. We don't take our players out. We don't not perform to the best of our ability. I played that for our team." Well, now we're preparing to play in the playoffs. Our first game is going to be against Tampa Bay. And I have to tell you this story because I take great pride in this. Fox had the Super Bowl that year, and Fox has their experts, as you know. You have Jimmy Johnson, Howie Long, you have Terry Bradshaw, Kurt Menefee. Not one of those experts picked the New York Giants to win one playoff game as we went along. So we go to Tampa, it's 85 degrees, we beat Tampa. We go to Dallas. Dallas has beaten us twice. Jerry Jones puts tickets to the NFC Championship game on each player's stool. So I find out, I just casually mentioned to our players that Jerry's already decided that tomorrow, you know, they've won the game. They don't have to play the game. They just handed out the tickets to the NFC Championship game. Well, that doesn't sit very well with our team. We drive it at the half score, take the lead. That crushes them. We beat them. Now we go to Green Bay for the NFC Championship game. Brett Favre, that outstanding football team. It's minus 27 degrees. I go on the field with no hat, no gloves for the workout. I'm out there about 5 minutes, and I'm saying to myself, how in the hell am I going to get inside to get a hat on? So that's a great ball game. I said to Lawrence Times, our field goal kicker, I said, "Lawrence, can you kick a 46-yard field goal?" He turned and walked away from me. At the end of regulation, bad snap from center. We should have made that field goal, but bad snap from center. He misses a 46-yarder. We get into overtime. The Green Bay wins the toss. First play, Favre throws a pick. Corey Webster intercepts the ball, runs it down. We gain nothing. Fourth down, it's a 47-yard field goal. I'm standing on the sideline. I don't say anything. I watch the kicker. He drops his cape and runs out on the field. I yell, "Field goal." Everybody's going, "Don't do that, coach. He'll miss the field goal. We'll give him the ball at midfield. Don't let him kick it." He goes out. He kicks the ball. He could have made it from 55 yards. So we make the field goal. We're in the Super Bowl. The great story about the Super Bowl is David Tyree. Friday of Super Bowl week, we're going to play the 18-0 New England Patriots, who have cruised through the playoffs. So Friday of that week is our green zone practice. David Tyree can't catch a thing. Drops every ball thrown to him. The ball's hitting him in the helmet. Can't catch it in his hands. Never sees the ball. Eli puts his arm around him and says, "Don't worry, David. When it comes your time, when the game is on the line, we know you'll perform." Well, you know the rest is history. Probably the greatest individual play in the history of field goals. Third down, middle of the field, very little time on the clock. Eli escapes from the rush. The referee, Mike Carey, almost blows the play dead. Eli throws the ball down the middle of the field, high in the air. It's recommended that you don't do that in our business. Most of those balls are intercepted. David Tyree jumps up in the middle of the field with a great Patriot safety, catches the ball in one hand, pinned against his helmet. The safety goes across the back of the legs of Tyree when he falls. Most of the time when that happens, you know, you let your hands go and you lose the ball. He hangs on to the ball. A couple plays later, we score. We win the game. The 18-0 New England Patriots are now 18-1. But the good Lord has got a plan. We're done, I think.
Tom, I thank you very much. I know that you are a great believer that the Lord puts us where we need to be, when we need to be there. You're a living example of this. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Coughlin, a wonderful Catholic, a wonderful family man, and a wonderful football coach. Tom Coughlin, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you. Go Jaguars! Thank you. Go Jaguars is right.